This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of November 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Austin ISD's school board votes to close four campuses against the pleading of its own equity officer.
The map that you have of the closures is a map of what 21st century racism looks like.
Abortion providers in Texas struggling to reopen clinics that had been closed because of state laws.
There are still clinics just concentrated in the major metropolitan areas of Texas.
And an Austin chorus whose members are losing their memories.
We feel and we see people actually wake up. That spark all of a sudden is there.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. That was the sound of children, parents, teachers, and politicians rallying outside Austin City Hall this week, trying to plead with the Austin School District's Board of Trustees not to vote to close four campuses. But in the end, they did vote to close those four campuses. KUT's Claire McInerney, our education reporter, was there for the meeting. What was it like there for the meeting, Claire?
90 people showed up to do public comments.
Is that a lot?
It's a lot. There's a new state law that allows unlimited public comment, so it's definitely more than the past where they used to cap it. But and a lot of people listening, and everyone there was very passionate, very adamant that they do not go forward with what they said was going to be a harmful decision for kids.
What schools are closing? What are the four elementary schools?
Brook Elementary, Metz Elementary, Sims, and Pease Elementary.
And where are those schools located generally?
Sims and Metz and Brook are all in East Austin, east of 35. Pease is right downtown. It's a unique school because it's all transfer, so parents, you know, opt in to come there. It doesn't pull from any neighborhood.
A lot of people who work downtown, I guess.
A lot of people who work downtown or live in near East Austin transfer to Pease.
Now, some of the big news of the night came from Austin ISD's chief equity officer. Her name is Stephanie Hawley, Dr. Stephanie Hawley, right? What happened there?
She is new to the district. They hired her this summer. She started in August in the middle of this process. They had already pretty much finished the first version of the plan of what they wanted to close schools. So she came in after that work had been done. And she's supposed to kind of keep an eye on equity and the budget and decisions like this. Since she started, she's been working on an equity report. She said she finished it last week and it wasn't made public before the vote. And so Trustee Arthi Singh brought this up and said, I want to know what was in the report. I wish I could have seen it. Will you come up and talk to us about your take on this closure plan and what we would have seen in that document? And Dr. Hawley came up and said, she was very honest and said, I'm proud of the people I work with. I think they are amazing people. They've done a lot to listen to me and learn about anti-racism work. But I don't think this plan achieves the equity they said they wanted to achieve.
The map that you have of the closures is a map of what 21st century racism looks like. We did not deliberately do that, but we didn't disrupt history. Our process for selecting schools was flawed. It was inequitable.
What does she mean by that comment, like, this is what 21st century racism looks like? Can you explain what she's referring to?
Yeah, what I've picked up from talking to her and listening to her is, and she said it right there, everybody's well-meaning, but Austin has a very, very racist past. We were segregated. We did not comply with Brown v. Board for decades, and that is existent in the schools, and it still is today. The same schools that were for Black students, for Latino students, like, still have a lot of minorities. That's a huge thing to tackle if you're a school board. But she was saying 21st century racism is not the you can't live in this neighborhood because of the color of your skin. It's closing those schools, disrupting those communities. That is a form of harming those families in the same way that, you know, rejecting housing, rejecting school access is.
trustees did try to make a few amendments to the proposal, mm-hmm. right? What were some of the mm-hmm. attempts to change this before they voted on it?
Trustee Ann Tyke, who voted against it, tried to put forward some motions about banning the district from selling buildings that are closed to developers and like using them as affordable housing and AIC being the landlord. But that seemed to be too legally confusing to figure out like in that moment. So that failed. And then Trustee Arthi Singh, who also voted against it, tried to remove Brook and Pease from the list. And, you know, her reasoning was the bond in 2017 has already started consolidating Metz and Sanchez and Norman and Sims, and Sims and Metz were on this closure vote. And so she was like, they're already building the new school. The kids are already coexisting. So I guess let's just go forward with that. But then Trustee Letitia Anderson, who represents Sims, said to pull Pease off, to pull Brook off and say like, oh, well, I guess that's already done. I guess we'll just let those schools go forward is not OK. And she got really passionate talking to Arthi about this on the dais.
Even after your statement, the message you are sending is one that you do not care. You only care for a specific area.
She was saying, just because Sims families and Metz families haven't been incredibly vocal, haven't been everywhere telling you not to close their school, doesn't mean they don't feel the same thing.
And in the end, it was not a unanimous vote from the dais, even though the vote to move forward with this process months ago was unanimous. What happened on Monday night?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, in February, the board unanimously said, yep, we're on board with school closures. Go forward and bring us a plan. But then three people, Ann Tyke, Arthi Singh, and Letitia Anderson, voted against it. They gave different reasons. Ann Tyke didn't like that it was this huge package. She had some issues with the closures, but like other parts of the plan that kind of expanded programming, but she voted against all of it. Trustee Singh read a really long statement just saying, I did a lot of thinking and reading and really thought about the equity piece. Do we disrupt these communities? Like, is it really going to save us a ton of money? Why aren't other schools being considered? So they clearly changed their mind in the last 9 months after talking with communities and getting more information.
School board members also heard from the woman who's responsible for crunching the numbers for AISD, their chief financial officer or chief of business operations, I think they call her. What did Nicole Conley tell the school board?
Ann Tyke, who voted against the plan, also said, I think we all need to be reminded of the financial situation we're in. And, you know, Nicole, will you come up? And so Nicole Conley came up and earnestly told them, and everyone in the room, everyone watching, AISD is in a dire financial situation. We send $600 million to the state in recapture. It's in a couple years going to be $800 million. Charters keep opening in East Austin and pull our kids away, which means we lose state funding. We have been going through our reserves, which is like their savings account. So they're blowing through their savings right now just to pay teachers, keep the lights on. And she said, next year, we will start with a deficit if something doesn't change.
So even if we break even this year, next year, we are guaranteed inflationary costs. The state funding provisions do not give you more money to for inflation. There was no inflationary factor. The only way to grow your money under the current system is to increase enrollment.
She was saying, you all were on board months ago that to save this money, we'd like to close schools rather than lay people off. And then when the vote came, you know, every member either read a statement or said their piece on why they were making their vote. And the ones who voted yes just said, we have to do something. We have so many schools. We have not enough kids. Schools were built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And the city just looks different. So,
well, and not enough kids. That's the other side of this, because declining enrollment means they get less money. And that's something that we haven't really touched on in this conversation. But that's a very important aspect of this, which goes back to how you just said Austin's changing, right?
Yeah. I mean, one reason I think affordability, it's not a low middle income place anymore where you can buy a house and have three kids and send them to the local school. Houses are super expensive. And so people are living in the suburbs or surrounding towns. Again, charter schools have come in and take thousands of kids each year. So there's just not enough kids. And, you know, this year they did see an increase in enrollment. So it's interesting to see if that continues. But all to say, Nicole made it sound like they can't wait another year to flesh out a plan. And that's on the district, that they weren't working on a proactive plan for years, knowing they needed to close schools. They did it in a couple of months.
KUT's education reporter Claire McInerney bringing us the news of the Austin School District's Board of Trustees voting to close 4 campuses, 4 elementary schools, mm-hmm. effective next school year.
Yep.
You can read more of Claire's reporting at KUT.org. Thanks for this, Claire.
Yeah, thank you.
Austin City Manager Spencer Kronk has chosen a Texas attorney to investigate claims of racism among the highest ranks of the police department. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports.
Kronk announced Lisa Tatum will lead the investigation. She's a former Bexar County Assistant Criminal District Attorney and served as outside counsel for the San Antonio Housing Authority. Last month, former APD Assistant Chief Justin Newsom was accused of using a racist term on a, quote, continuous basis to describe black people. That includes a former city council member and a former chief at APD. Tatum will look into these claims, plus claims that Police Chief Brian Manley does not hold higher-ups at the department to the same standard as lower-ranking officers. No word from the city about what the investigation will cost or how long it will take. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
This week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced the end of safety rules regulating how companies store certain dangerous chemicals. The rules were created in response to a 2013 fertilizer plant explosion in Central Texas. KUT's Mose Bouchel reports.
Under the Obama-era rules, businesses were required to notify nearby communities about certain chemicals, follow best practices, and get a third-party audit if an accident happened. But the Trump administration says those rules were burdensome and raised security concerns. Tommy Mushka is the mayor of the Texas town of West, where the fertilizer plant explosion killed 15 people. He says he's disappointed.
I think that politicians have very short memories, not only with what happened back in 2013.
Since the explosion in West 6 years ago, there have been other chemical plant accidents across the U.S., including one earlier this year in Crosby, Texas, that left one person dead and 2 injured. Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
The city of Austin is looking for solutions to parking challenges in the area around South Congress. KUT Samuel King reports a recent study found employees, visitors, and residents often fight for the most convenient spaces.
The Austin Transportation Department, the Downtown Austin Alliance, and neighborhood groups partnered for this study and found that while spaces along Congress and nearby streets are often full, only about 60% of spaces in the overall area are taken at any particular time. ATD's Anna Martin says the study also found that rules for streets with residential permit parking can be confusing.
It can be underutilized during the day, meaning when employees for the businesses at SoCo are looking for a place to park during the day, a lot of those blocks are empty. There's some capacity, parking capacity, that's being underutilized.
Martin says the city is encouraged. The study showed about half of the people who travel to South Congress get there by some other means than driving alone. The city is now coming up with some solutions to the parking issues with a final plan expected by the spring. Samuel King, KUT News.
This year has brought an unprecedented wave of new state laws that only allow abortions to be performed early in pregnancy, if at all. Supporters of abortion rights have sued in an attempt to overturn the laws, and the legal fights appear headed to the Supreme Court. Texas could tell us something about how things might play out, because a few years ago, the state legislature passed a new law. Abortion providers sued, and they won. But even though they won the legal battle, half the clinics in Texas disappeared. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports.
The Planned Parenthood Clinic in San Angelo, Texas, used to occupy a gray one-story building on Pecos Street. Suzanne Fernandez worked here for almost 30 years.
At the beginning, it pulled some strings inside. I loved working for Planned Parenthood.
The building now houses a wealth management company. But whenever Fernandez drives by, which is often, she still feels a pang of loss.
Even the blocks in front of the building that have inscriptions on them, they're all still there.
Inscriptions naming donors who financially supported the clinic through the decades it was open. Before it closed in 2013, this clinic was one of the last places to get an abortion in West Texas. Now, women have to drive at least 3 hours to the nearest major city. Fernandez blames Texas lawmakers. A law they passed in 2013 required abortion clinics to operate like surgical centers. It also required doctors who do abortions to affiliate with a nearby hospital. Fernandez says the new rules were too expensive or just impossible to comply with.
The last day was sad, was somber. You know, we all knew that was it.
To fight the law, abortion providers in Texas sued. But the legal challenge slogged on, and the state kept cutting its budget for family planning services. Both pressures forced many women's health clinics to close their doors. In less than 2 years, Texas went from having more than 40 such clinics to less than 20. Carrie White helped study the fallout for the Texas Policy Evaluation Project.
West Texas and South Texas, access was incredibly limited, and women living in those parts of the state were more than 100 miles, sometimes 200 or more miles from the nearest facility.
White's research team conducted surveys and interviews with patients as clinics were shutting down. A 19-year-old woman told the researchers she almost gave up on getting an abortion because she couldn't find an open clinic. We asked a staffer from the research project to read that 19-year-old's words out loud for us.
It was a very hard thing to do, like to keep calling and calling and calling. I almost was like, you know, well, forget it. But then because I knew at the end of the day it was something that I had to do, I don't care how many people I have to call or how far I have to go, I have to do it.
That woman eventually found a clinic 70 miles away and was able to get the abortion. But in some cases, women had to go on with unwanted pregnancies. One 23-year-old woman from Waco, Texas, was married and already had 2 children. She told the researchers that she made appointments at 2 different clinics. But both appointments were canceled after the clinics were forced to close. The staffer reads out loud from her story.
I was pretty upset. But I just decided that I guess I'll have to just ride it out. I didn't know what else to do, who else to call.
In the summer of 2016, 3 years after the Texas law passed, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the 2 key requirements involving the clinic upgrades and the doctor's admitting privileges. But most of the state's clinics never managed to reopen. There are far fewer abortion clinics in Texas today, 22 at last count. Again, researcher Carrie White.
There are still clinics just concentrated in the major metropolitan areas of Texas. So access is still a challenge for many women in the state.
John Sego is with Texas Right to Life. He says what happened in Texas has been a mixed bag for him, too.
The closures of clinics is definitely a victory for the movement, obviously. However, how are we in this situation in the first place is what my organization looks at.
By this situation, Sego is referring to Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion nationwide. He wants that overturned. Abortion rights advocates were encouraged recently when a new abortion clinic opened earlier this year in Texas. It's in Houston, a city that already has some clinics.
Due to the closures of so many clinics, the remaining clinics that are open are very busy. So our goal was to offer flexibility in scheduling.
This is Kathy Kleinfeld. She recently opened this new clinic in Houston. It offers abortion by medication through taking pills, but not the surgical procedure. She says so far her patients have been a mix of professionals, students, and women who drive over from Louisiana. Kleinfeld says getting this clinic up and running was no easy task.
There's always been conflict and struggles, always. This is not for the faint of heart.
Andrea Ferrigno works for Whole Woman's Health, which operates several clinics in Texas offering abortion. After the 2013 law, Whole Woman's had to close 2 clinics, one in Austin and one in Beaumont, a small city near the Louisiana border. Eventually, the managers were able to reopen the Austin clinic, but couldn't pull that off in Beaumont.
It's basically starting from scratch. You know, you laid off a staff, you don't have any physicians that work there anymore. Some of the doctors actually didn't even renew their physician licenses.
If doctors are available, though, reopening is tough.
If a clinic's operating license has lapsed, it has to get a new one from the state. Some clinics also lost their leases and had to sell off equipment.
There's also the fear of security challenges, people picketing the clinic, picketing their homes.
Back in San Angelo, there still isn't anywhere to get an abortion in town. Suzanne Fernandez sometimes wonders what happens to the patients she used to help, not just with abortions, but also things like pap smears, breast cancer screenings, and contraception.
When you get out, go to the grocery store, whatever, you run into people. And there is that thing in the back of your mind, where did these women go? Or where do they go now? I don't believe a lot of them found any other health care afterwards.
Providers in Texas say they want to eventually reopen some of the rural clinics that closed, if it ever becomes possible. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Austin resident Cody Wilson, the self-described anarchist and a figurehead of the 3D printed gun movement, is back in the 3D printed gun business. Earlier this year, he pleaded guilty to the felony charge of injury to a child and received 7 years probation. Now he's a registered sex offender. KUT's Andrew Weber has a new story about this in collaboration with Alon Stevens, a former KUT employee who's now a reporter at The Trace, which reports on gun violence in America. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Nathan.
A lot of people might be wondering how someone who pleaded guilty to a felony charge could be in the 3D printed gun business, because generally speaking, felons are not allowed to possess firearms. So can you give us a bit of background on Cody Wilson's criminal case?
This all starts in September of 2018, when Wilson was accused of sexual assault in an instance in which he apparently solicited sex online with a 16-year-old girl. And he was charged with sexual assault of a minor and fled to Taipei in Taiwan. He was arrested there about a week later and extradited to Houston and charged. Cut to about a year later, in August, he took a plea deal that would mean he wouldn't serve jail time. He would be on 7 years probation and would register as a sex offender. This whole process is called deferred adjudication. And a couple of weeks ago, he came out in an interview and he said that Travis County does not prohibit him from voting or from owning a firearm. So that's sort of where Alon and my investigation began.
What is the business that Cody Wilson is involved with, that he founded?
Defense Distributed is a company that has a couple of other subsidiaries that mainly focus on a product called the Ghost Gunner, which technically doesn't 3D print guns. It takes a piece of material and then, using what's called a computer-aided design file, whittles out the receiver for a firearm like an AR-15.
So it's milling it, basically.
Yes, it's milling, exactly. This is something he's been doing since he was a law student here. I believe you interviewed him in 2013 when he sort of was starting out. Mm-hmm. And it is a way to manufacture firearms that is untraceable. They don't have serial numbers.
And now they're coming out with a new Ghost Gunner. What can you tell us about that?
It is the Ghost Gunner 3, and it has the ability to mill the receiver for an AK-47.
What does the Travis County District Attorney's Office have to say about this?
That Cody Wilson is more or less right. He can possess a firearm, and that in doing so, he would not violate his probation. But Assistant District Attorney Joe Frederick told me that, yes, he would be able to possess a firearm, but
where he could get into trouble would be if he's on probation and he somehow registers new firearm, somehow gets new guns, or, you know, purchases a new gun as part of his business. That could violate his probation, and that would be a gray area.
What did Cody Wilson say when you talked to him?
He pretty much said that's how he views it, and that's what his probation officer told him. And he is going to continue running his business. And he would argue it is not necessarily a firearms business, because they're trafficking in these machines that shape material into what becomes a receiver for a gun, and that they're actually not even really selling firearms. They're selling files, those computer-aided design files.
Defense Distributed is also involved in this legal battle over the distribution of files for what are actually 3D printable guns, right? Not the milled stuff, but the items that you can make with a 3D printer. What's going on with that?
So that case goes back to 2015. Cody Wilson and Defense Distributed sued the State Department. And then that case was sort of in limbo for a bit. And the State Department under the Trump administration reached a deal with Defense Distributed, allowing them to distribute the files because they didn't violate federal laws for international traffic of firearms. But last week, a federal judge overruled that deal. So now they're banned from distributing the files. But Defense Distributed has appealed that decision.
KUT's Andrew Weber, you can read his story about this at KUT.org. It's headlined, "Despite his criminal record, Cody Wilson is back in the 3D printed gun business." Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nathan.
Nearly 6 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease. Leads to memory loss, leads to other cognitive impairment. One part of the brain tends to be relatively unharmed by Alzheimer's, and that is the part that stores musical memory. Michelle Dahlenberg has this story about a new program in Austin that aims to help people with memory loss through song.
It's a Monday morning in September, the very first rehearsal of the Love Notes chorus. It looks like a typical choir rehearsal. There are rows of about 30 black chairs set up in a semicircle in a corner of a church fellowship hall. A grand piano, a music stand, a guitar. The choir members are gathered around a snack table, eating cupcakes, hugging each other, and laughing. So much laughing. It feels less like a choir rehearsal and more like a reunion of old friends. All the people are here because they love to sing. But there's something special about this choir that you can't tell just by looking at it. This is a choir for people with early memory loss, their caregivers, and volunteers.
I'm Marcia Crosby. I wish I was related to Bing Crosby, but that just doesn't happen.
Is it okay to ask you how old you are?
Oh, wait a minute, I have to. 81.
Marcia is in the early stages of memory loss.
And it's very frustrating, very, very frustrating.
She grew up in New England, surrounded by music.
On Sundays, we'd go over to Grandma's house, and there was a piano there. And, of course, after a while, we started playing the piano, and we all started to sing. So anywhere there's a piano and music, we're there with it. And it's a good feeling.
Marcia has sung in choirs her whole life. Her son heard about the Love Notes chorus and signed her up. She can't drive anymore because of the memory loss. So she was paired up with two volunteers who pick her up and take her to rehearsal every Monday.
My name is Butch Stansel. I am in seventh grade and I am 13 years old.
And his mom.
I'm Allison Stansel.
Allison and Birch signed up to be volunteer singers.
It was something that he and I could do together. And we were so excited that we got paired with Marcia, and we've just had a wonderful time.
What did you think when you first met her?
I thought, this is going to be great. She was just such a... She was so happy to come, and it was...
I love you, Birch. I love you.
The three of them share a music stand. Sometimes they're having so much fun that they distract each other and mess up.
Clapping, not clapping.
Whoops, whoops.
Yeah. So we're keeping each other in line.
Yeah.
Love Notes Chorus was started this fall by Edie Elkier and Susie Higley. They've been best friends for over 30 years. The choir is part of their organization, Music Memories Austin. They do music workshops for people in retirement communities and assisted living and memory care facilities.
And we love what we're doing.
That's Susie. She says they often see things that astonish them.
We feel and we see people actually wake up. That spark all of a sudden is there.
Susie recalls a workshop they did with a woman who had very late stage Alzheimer's. She had a difficult time coming up with her own thoughts and expressing herself.
We were singing on the good ship Lollipop, And we said something like, oh, this was a Shirley Temple song. And all of a sudden, her little feet start moving underneath her chair. And the woman started singing with us. And we had not heard her sing before. She usually just watched everybody. We finished the song, and she says, what just happened? We were so stunned. Here's this woman who has not spoken a word of her own thought the whole time we've been meeting. And I said, music just happened. I couldn't think of what else to say. I was so completely blown away by it. And then she looked at me and she said, music is good for me. And at this point, we just started crying. It was just, we couldn't hold it back. It was so monumental an experience to see this woman who had been locked in this body and was just all of a sudden expressing this person that had been there all along, but we hadn't met her yet.
For their concert later this week, the choir is singing songs on the theme of peace, love, and joy. Most of the songs are familiar to the choir members, but some find it challenging to learn their parts. Edie reassures them.
I want to reiterate that there is no wrong in this room. There is no wrong, everybody. If you get frustrated, I don't want that. There is really and truly no wrong, and you can do just the melody if you want to.
A month later, in mid-October, I'm back at Love Note's chorus rehearsal. It's clear that they've had a few more rehearsals under their belt.
My favorite song is I Love the Mountains. It didn't start off that way, but it's grown on me.
That's Birch again. Here's Allison.
Most of the songs people are somewhat familiar with. So yeah. I think the stress of trying to learn the music has been low. And because everybody's enjoying it, it doesn't really feel like work.
And Marcia.
We all like to sing. We all love music. So we're doing it together. And that's fun. It really is.
I think it's just the miracle of music.
That's Susie again.
I think it's the miracle of touching that part of the brain that is still connected to the soul, that is that person's own being, that special, noble being that's hiding in there, that has always been there, but that somehow through music seems to shine.
Just listening to music or singing music, I think your brain is working. Your brain is in tune.
How does it make your brain feel when you're singing in the Love Notes Choir?
I would say good. And I talked to my brain. I said, brain, you did a good job today.
Michelle Dahlenberg, KUT News.
The Love Notes Chorus will perform tomorrow afternoon at 3 at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church on Mesa Drive in Austin. You can find the details at KUT.org. That's KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of November 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶